Okay.
Let's take it in terms of just a kind of geographical movement. Starting from here, if we were to go up North Denver Avenue, for example, some of the first sites looking off to the right would be the old community theater built as Tulsa's Convention Hall, which was closed this spring with the opening of the Performing Arts Center. The Convention Hall was the first name, and as I recall, it was built in 1913. And became the first home and continued as such for the International Petroleum Exposition, which was founded here in that building in 1923 or 24. That was also one of the two internment camps for black Tulsans following the days of the race riot in 1921.
Okay. Yeah, we need to do that.
Going on up Denver, between Cheyenne and Denver, just south of the bypass, south of the street which runs along the south edge of the small shopping center with the drugstore and the donut place and stuff. Mm-hmm. In the middle of that block was the original site of the Sylvester Morris House, which is the old one that's been moved over to Owen Park. It was built in the middle of that block. I think the address was 400-something North Cheyenne, sitting back into the block. Coming on across, the intersection of Edison and Denver marks the south and east corner, the borderline between the Cherokee Nation and the Creek Nation, or Osage Nation, I'm sorry. And at one time, there was a plaque or some kind of marker embedded in the old street as it ran there. And whether that marker is still underneath layers of paving or whether it was removed and placed somewhere, I don't know. But at one time, there was a marker denoting that. Moving on up, probably the next site would be the Brady home on the southwest corner of Golden and Denver. That was built by Tate Brady, an early Tulsa developer who owned much of the land in that area. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. That marker was not on Denver and Edison. It was at the corner of Edison and Osage Drive, which would be a little bit further west. On to the Brady, figured in a number of early developments, including the Brady Hotel and the Brady Annex, which is what remains of the Goodwill Building down there along Archer Street. Was quite a figure, entertained early politicians and leaders of the state in his mansion there on North Denver. He's said to have entertained early governors of the state and so forth. Just immediately east from there, on the northwest corner of Golden and Cheyenne, is the Gross Heart Sanitarium, which was one of Tulsa's first medical facilities. And according to Fannie Mish, who's with the Tulsa County Historical Society, it was in operation at or shortly after the turn of the century, and had a was distinguished by having a cistern on the roof, which kept water pressure for surgery and whatnot. On up Denver, there's several places that I don't know very much about. The is it Haskell where the expressway ends? Can you take that?
I'm not sure.
Anyhow, the street just going north from the street which leads to the stump end of the Osage Expressway on the west side of the street, about midway in that block, is a 2.5 or 3 story frame house with captain's walks around the top and so forth. That was built by one of But that house along North Denver was built by one of Tulsa's early oil men, and I don't recall the name. I have never gotten it written down and whatnot. The present owner of that house is Mrs. Alquita Goodwin, and she had looked through the abstract and told me a little bit about it, so she might be able to fill in the gap on that one. Somewhere along in there, on north from King, on the east side of the street, is a house that's been rehabilitated. It's kind of a brown-gray color, with large numerals on the front. And that was, as I understand it, one of the early homes of the Vandiver family. And there are other houses along in there, which I've never had the time or taken the time to talk with people and find out exactly who lived where. Fannie Mish, again, is probably one of the best authorities on that area. And then on up to Reservoir Hill, where the Mayos lived for a time. John Rogers' brother, John Rogers, the attorney here in Tulsa, his brother owns the Wide Horizons. He passed away 2 or 3 years ago. His widow still lives there, and they were quite a force in maintaining some integration on the hill when that began to occur. On back down, the kindergarten building on the campus at Burroughs Elementary School was one of four original branch libraries built by the city library system in the early 20s, I believe. It and the East 2nd Street Library, which is still in operation, and then there were two others whose locations I don't know. But that's what that building originally was. Coming back down Main Street from Pine, again through Pine, or through Main, Cheyenne, Boulder, Denver, all the way across there, there are probably numerous families whose names are fairly commonplace now in Tulsa history who lived there at one time or another. My understanding is that many of them lived there first, and then as they gathered their wealth through oil or through commercial enterprises or whatever, they were gradually able to move to the Maple Ridge area after that became an attractive place to live, which it wasn't initially. Coming on down, the old Emerson Elementary School has been torn down now, but coming on down to the intersection where Main curves eastward and forms a Y with Cheyenne coming northward, there are several buildings along in there. Just south of that corner on the east side of the street, sitting back behind another storefront, just indented, not sitting behind, sitting back from the front, is a building which was built by Tulsa's Jewish community as a Jewish institute. And you can see Stars of David on the front of it. I don't know what it's been in the intervening years, but it was built, I would guess, close to 1920, either before or after, and was an initial attempt on the part of the Jewish community in town to bring together the Orthodox and conservative and more liberal ends of the Jewish tradition here. It, for example, had dances and things there in addition to the Hebrew and religious classes, which were open to all Jewish children. It also had dances where men and women actually danced together, which was an attempt to get away from the synagogue kind of style where the men sat in one place, the women in another, and made for a more social kind of setting. Coming on down the street, on the east side, is the fire station number 2, which is listed on the map. That was the first branch fire station built in the city. And probably
stop for a minute. Mm-hmm. I was unable to, in the survey, locate fire station number 2, and it didn't. The people at Tulsa Urban Renewal Authority couldn't find it on their aerial map either.
Okay.
I don't know where it is.
It is now the ANA Fire Protection Company.
Okay.
And it sits just immediately north of the Beano Hall.
Okay.
Plan building.
Okay.
The ANA Fire Protection Company, and there are some old photographs that they've got hanging on the wall in there, and it was a fire station, was originally developed by the father of the man who now runs it. And when I talked to him a year or two back, his father was still alive, though somewhat senile and not in very good condition. But his father had been a fireman in that station, and then after retiring from the fire department, had begun the fire protection company as a family business, and had bought that location when it became available. So the owner there, with possibilities of talking with the father, would be a good source of information. The Beano Hall, we've got some information on that. That was originally the site back in about 1906 or 7 of a Methodist congregation. The Tigert Memorial Methodist Church. And the Tigert Memorial Methodist Church was founded by a Methodist clergyman, I believe a missionary, who was visiting in Tulsa and attempting to begin a congregation in 1905 or 6 and died at the time of a heart attack or some malady. And the congregation went on and formed and named the church in his memory. That church moved out prior to 1920, probably about 1915 or 16. It had been a small frame building and moved over to build a new building, which is now Centenary Methodist Church at Golden and Denver. And the original cornerstone from Tigert Memorial Church is sitting there right in front of the Centenary Methodist Church and has dates and things on it. The frame building apparently was torn down and a Klan built the hall sometime 1919, 1920, somewhere along in there, at a time when the Klan was enjoying a good deal of popularity in this area. It was functioning as a kind of police vigilante force, doing some good things and a lot of things that were somewhat questionable. They were, for example, as vigilantes, policing the running of whiskey and guns to Indian groups in this area, especially out around Sand Springs. They had a big thing about family structure and where a man had abandoned his family. If they could find him, they would, and they would strap him to a tree and beat him to teach him a lesson that he shouldn't run away and leave his family. From that hall, from the time it was built on into the late 20s, 1927 or 28, when the Klan decreased in popularity and kind of moved on, parades began from that point down North Main Street and around and up Boston, sometimes swinging over into Greenwood with riders in full regalia with torches and all kinds of whatnot. And there are stories of a Klan initiation ceremony back in about 1922 or 3 on a hill somewhere between Tulsa and Broken Arrow along the highway, where it was estimated that some 3,500 people were in attendance, and there were cars backed up almost all the way to Tulsa and almost all the way to Broken Arrow. In 1923 or 24, there was a Klan wedding in Tulsa, which was the only recorded instance that anyone seems to have ever heard of throughout the country of a wedding where everyone was in Klan regalia. And they, you know, they would take money gifts and food and things to widows and do their good things also. It came to be known as the Beano Hall, and there are two opinions on how that came about. One is that the first listing of the Klan building and the Tulsa Telephone Directory was under the title the Tulsa Benevolent Association. So some people say that's why it was called Beano. Others contend that it was because of a Klan motto at that time, which they say went something like, "Be no niggers, be no Catholics, be no Jews allowed." So you can kind of take your pick on which theory runs true. That building was, the Klan moved out in the late 20s. In the meantime, it became a roller skating rink at one point. It was a lumber yard at one point. And by the early to mid 1940s, it had been bought by Tulsa evangelist Steve Pringle. And Pringle was a tent evangelist type. And what he did was set up his tent various places, and then he would preach, but he would also invite other preachers in and share the financial resources with them. And it was in the mid-1940s that he first invited a young evangelist who had recently dropped out of school at Phillips University in Enid to pastor a church there over to do a week as a visiting evangelist. He had his tent set up on Standpipe Hill, and one night, well, the young man proved very promising, and so it kept him on for an additional week, and it might have turned into 3 or 4 weeks. But one night, someone was driving up North Cincinnati, probably had a little bit too much to drink, and took shooting off a gun, fired a couple of shots through the tent. The news services picked that up at that time, and put it on the wires that somebody had taken a few pot shots at this evangelist in a tent in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that was the first time that the name of Oral Roberts had been heard basically outside of this area. He probably, although no one has said specifically, he probably preached in that building since that was Pringle's base of operations in those days. Since that time, it's changed hands a few more times, but continued in a religious vein, and the current owner is into some kind of missionary activity in South America, is a fairly aged man, and is trying to have the thing torn down so he can sell the land and put the money into these missionary enterprises that he has. After they began tearing it down, the people who were doing that, the agent for him, received word from the Klan that if there were any artifacts in the walls or anything like that, they didn't want those falling into anybody's hands but theirs, and that they would be checking up on it. So apparently there's still some interest on their part. Coming on under the IDL there, on the east side of the street again, is Kane's Ballroom. It has a plaque above the door which has a date of something like 1896 or 1898 and the name Tate Brady. It also has a date of about 1926 or 28 on there. Yeah, 1890 and 1924. Well, that was close. apparently, the 1890 date refers to Tate Brady's ownership of the land, because he owned most of the land in that area on over to his mansion. The 1924 is probably the date when the building was built. And in 1928 or 29, I think it was 29, the building began being used as Kane's Dance Studio, or Dance Academy, and Ballroom. And into the early 30s, it became one of two places in Tulsa around which nightlife began to center, particularly in terms of country and Western music. And the old Bob Wills and Johnny Lee Wills bands and others began playing at both the Kane's Ballroom and the Blue Moon, which is situated up north and west of the intersection of 36th Street North and Cincinnati. But those two places became real focuses during that time for nightlife and for country and Western music, and began to put Tulsa on the map in terms of the country swing style of the Wills brothers and their bands. In the mid-1940s, KVOO radio station, which at that time was owned and operated, had been built by transferring a license from, I believe, Muskogee by William G. Skelly, began broadcasting live from Kane's. And KVOO at that time and up to the present time had managed to get a license which allowed them a pretty sizable wattage at night. And so at night, when they were broadcasting live from Kane's, it could be heard all the way out to the Rocky Mountains and up into Montana. People could pick it up. And that probably more than anything else put Tulsa on the map in terms of people knowing about Tulsa, hearing a style of music, and several other things. So I think it probably has a very significant role to play in Tulsa's history. There's still people, by the way, who call Kane's wanting to know who's playing. They've been listening to it for years and years and years on the radio, and they might be coming through town, so they'll call and find out. Most of the time when they call, it's been open, and then sometimes when it's closed. coming on down that street, down North Main, there are a lot of apartment buildings and stuff in that old business area. And in the days shortly after the turn of the century, that was probably the more important part of downtown, more significant than what was going on south of the tracks. Most of the early merchants had set up shop along the north side of the tracks for some reason. But I don't know the ownership or history of much of many of the buildings that are still there in that area. At Main and Archer, on the south west corner is the Brady Hotel Annex, the Goodwill building, which is still standing. And it had become the Goodwill thing quite a few years ago, and had been used as a workshop and whatnot, storage place mostly, and was burned, with severe damage to at least the upper stories, about 3 years back. That was built as the annex to the hotel that Brady built. Brady got into competition with another hotel builder, who was, I think, right across the street there on Main Street. And so the annex, the tall building, was built in part of as part of this war between the landlords or whatever. I understand, though I have not seen it personally, that if you go down through a manhole in the sidewalk in front of that building, down to what used to be the street level, there is a plaque on the front indicating that that's where the first governor of the state of Oklahoma announced his candidacy, which would have been either just prior to or just after the time of statehood. It has also been said, and could probably be checked out, the people who have told me, I believe, and they say that the, I believe it was second governor of the state, was staying there for a speaking engagement at a time later on when he picked up this newfangled thing called the telephone, called back to Guthrie, which was then the state capital, and told him it was okay, he had his alibi, and it was all right for them to steal the state seal and take it to Oklahoma City. But it's quite a building and not in very good shape. The moving on to the east along Archer is the John 316 Rescue Mission, which now is the Rescue Mission and a pre-release center for the State Board of Corrections. It was built as the original, built as the home of the Tulsa Tribune. It still has the Tribune sign above the door in concrete there. It at one time had two owls sitting up on either side of the door, one of which at least is sitting in the entryway of the new Tribune offices in their building downtown. Since it was the Tribune, it must have been built in the 19-teens, sometime probably prior to 1920. The Tribune had originally been the Tulsa Democrat, and prior to being bought by the Joneses and turned into the Tribune, only about that time, it had been owned by Charles Page. And Page had been an early benefactor of the city, a community leader who owned that paper and did a number of other things. And he got into a fight with the city of Tulsa over where the water supply was going to come from. He had proposed a small lake out near what the present Sand Springs. The Tulsa World, which had earlier been the Tulsa Republican, which had earlier been the Tulsa Indian Chief, and owned at that time by the Lorton family, Eugene Lorton, was arguing in terms of building a pipeline to Spavinaw. And a heated campaign went on for some time. Finally, an election was held, and it was decided that the water would come from Spavinaw. It was about that time that Page sold the newspaper, figuring the public opinion was against him and whatnot, and moved out to Sand Springs, which was land that he owned, and ended up putting together his own town out there. The Sand Springs Railway waiting room used to be just about across the street from where the John 316 Mission is now. I don't believe it is there any longer, the old one, but it probably would have been the oldest standing commercial building in town. It was torn down about 2 years ago by urban renewal. But Page went on to build Sand Springs and set up a trust at the time of his death back in the 30s with the Sand Springs Widows and Orphans Colony, the Sand Springs Home, as the beneficiary. And that was one of five of his interests. Another was the Sand Springs Townsite Development Company, which built houses and whatnot. The Old Reliable Oil Company. He had a farms, the Sand Spring Farms or something like that. And what was the other one? The railway. And at the time of his death, Sand Springs Home interests were set up as a trust with the home as the beneficiary, and have since been overseen by a group of five directors, one for each of the enterprises, all appointed for life terms by the Grand Master of Freemasonry in the Consistory in Guthrie, Oklahoma. They figured rather prominently in Tulsa County politics, especially the west part of the county, since that time. Moving on across Archer.
Okay, pause for a minute. All right, stop.
It's almost seeing my mind after doing it 15, 20 times a year. coming on eastward on Archer Street, Cincinnati was the old dividing line between the white and the black communities. West of Cincinnati was, in the early days of the century, up until the time of the riot and continuing past that time to some extent, a very prestigious white area. And the houses along North Denver and whatnot and up toward Reservoir Hill were extremely important. There's also another area over in there that I don't know much about, the Country Club Heights addition, which is along Osage Drive and Country Club Drive up into there. I think Bob Hardy has a good bit of information on that, but I've never sat down and picked his mind on it. Anyhow, going on across Archer, crossing Cincinnati into the old black area, Archer from that point on and curving up around Greenwood was at one time a very thriving business community. Many of the people who owned businesses, especially on Greenwood itself, were black. At the corner of Detroit and Archer, on the southwest corner, is the what I understand to be the old Tulsa Ice House, where ice was made down in the ground floor, and that ramp that goes up to the second floor was because the horses and wagons were stored up there. I've often wondered how many people ended up with straw and whatnot in their ice, but never found out. It's now owned by the man who owns Fleener's Tires across Detroit, and it's an antique store.
It was just there yesterday.
Going on, the old welfare office, which was vacated about 2 years ago when the state office complex was built, is now the U-Haul place for Central Tulsa. I don't recall the name of the man who built that, but it was built by a white man, and it was primarily an office operation. At the corner of Archer and Greenwood, on the south side of Archer, moving on east from there, is an old apartment house with looks like almost like a modern motel with a balcony along the upper story rooms and a shop in the front. That and the apartment buildings, there a couple more built on to the east of it, were owned, as I understand it, by white folks. Nixon was the name of one. Redfern, who was a mixed blood Indian, owned some property in there. Hopper was another name. You know, I don't tie them down too much. Then in the 100 block of Greenwood coming northward, that was virtually all black, though Redfern did own a theater along in there at one time. That area was built starting initially about 1907 or 1908. There were some small frame buildings there, but the first brick buildings started going up at that time. Mr. W.D. Williams, William D. Williams, who lives on North Denver Boulevard, is a retired teacher from Booker T. Washington High School. His family built the building on the northwest corner, and it still says the Williams Building on there, even though it was rebuilt after the riot. And it was built pretty much the way it is now. They had a confectionery on the ground floor and lived on one of the two upper floors and had some people with offices on the other upper floor. They also built across the street, on the east side, just about where the expressway comes through now, the first theater in Greenwood, which was the Dreamland Theater. It was built in about 1916. And They had advertising. I've seen a paperweight, for example, a photograph of a paperweight advertising it with a picture of the theater and saying it had the finest, it was the finest colored theater in the Southwest. I'm assuming the films were probably in black and white, plus the vaudeville ads. Moving on up the street, the Bryant family, the Black family, owned an area along there. Dr. Bryant, as he was called, was a pharmacist, and he built a building or two along there. There were some other activities going on. There was a thing called the Palm Garden, which I believe predated the riot. It may not have been until after the riot, which was a speakeasy in the front and had an outdoor or indoor boxing arena in the back. And kids in the Black community would go there every afternoon and work out and learn how to box and stuff. And a couple nights a week they'd have boxing matches. On the east side of the street were rooming houses and whatnot, shops along there. That whole area was destroyed by the riot and then was rebuilt. And the way it is situated now, starting out on the west side of the street, is the Williams Building, which remained a confectionery and office and apartment. Then the Bryant Building, which is connected to the Alpheta Building. Alpheta was the daughter of Dr. Bryant, so he owned both of those fronts. There was one building with two fronts, and called one the Bryant Building and one the Alpheta. And there's another office building of some kind in there. Let's see. Yeah, which most recently was a hardware store. And another one, the site where the Oklahoma Eagle is now, was back in the 20s and 30s, the Dixie Theater. And that's where the Palm Garden had been before the riot. And then a couple of more, another office building, the Smith Building, and a couple of small shops on up that side of the street. I don't have to pick the other side of the street. The other side of the street had the rooming house on the corner and several other rooming house type things, all with shops along the front. There was a pharmacy along in there owned by Lloyd Williams' family. Lloyd is a pharmacist in Tulsa now. I think he's connected with Moton. But his father had been a pharmacist and had a shop along there. And Dreamland Theater was rebuilt. The Oklahoma Eagle was situated in an older building for most of those years over there on the east side of the street. And then down around the corner on Archer, east of Greenwood, on the north side of Archer, was where the garage was that Simon Berry owned. And Simon Berry developed a jitney bus service up and down Greenwood prior to the time of the riot, and continued after that time, serviced his vehicles there and worked on other people's vehicles. He also had what was called Simon Berry's Park and Dance Pavilion, which was a place where Black folks from all over eastern Oklahoma would come, especially on Juneteenth, which is the day for celebrating Black independence in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas. That's when the word of the Emancipation Proclamation reached here. But on Juneteenth, he would have all kinds of people out there in his park and dance pavilion on up into the late 30s. And he owned an airplane, too, and would take people on airplane rides to look at the city and whatnot. He sold his jitney bus service to the city, which became part of the transit system, with the specification that they hired as Black drivers as well. And sold the park and dance pavilion to the city, and it is now Lincoln Park. Okay, going on up Greenwood, on the east side of the street with an address of something like 323 or 325, is a small building which was built in 1931 by the city as a precinct police station jail. And it is still standing. It later became the first permanent home for the Hutcherson Branch YMCA, which is now located on East Pine Street near Peoria. And after they moved out, it was used for various and sundry things, most recently as a meeting place for a black church. On the west side of...
Could I ask you a question about the precinct station?
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't find 323 North Greenwood. We found 327. And it was had a year date above the front door, 1931. Seven. Yeah, that's it. That's what we found.
Yeah. Okay, it was listed as 323 in one of the reports that I saw. Mm-hmm. There's an old report somewhere, so the address apparently was changed. Okay, the precinct station, Hutcherson Y. On behind that, further east from Greenwood, where the city street department garage is now, there were two or three things in there at one time. That was the original site of Dunbar School. And it was also the site of the Black Hospital, which predated Moton. After the riot, a white Red Cross worker came to Tulsa to coordinate some of the relief efforts. His name was Morris Willows, M-A-U-R-I-C-E.
Excuse me.
Yeah. The Lord
worships
this
for you all.
Okay, thank you.
And following the riot, a hospital was formed by pulling two or three frame houses together. James Goodwin, Ed Goodwin Sr.'s father, who was an undertaker and developer in those days, was one of the people involved in that process and got it going. The first administrator was a woman named Dimple Bush, who was the only really trained medical person in Tulsa. She was a nurse. They had several pharmacists, but no doctor. And so that continued as the Black Community Hospital from shortly after the time of the riot up until about 1931, when Moton was built up on Pine Street. And Moton continued as a hospital until the early 60s, when it folded and was opened again as an ambulatory care center through the Model Cities Program of the County Health Department in the late 60s. On the west side of Greenwood, along in there, the 300, 400 block, whatever, there's a storefront with apartment kind of contraption that's left there with the name Bridgewater. Dr. Bridgewater was one of the early, he was one of the first medical people in Tulsa also. And I don't recall whether he was a pharmacist or a physician. I think he was a physician because he had, he may have been a pharmacist. It was Dr. Bryant who was the doctor. If you turn, on the corner of Easton and Greenwood, the southwest corner is an old home which was built shortly after the riot, a substantial brick building with tile roof, which is still fairly well maintained. It was originally built by Mrs. Mackley, and she had built a rather substantial frame house on its site prior to the riot, which had been destroyed. She was a Creek freedman and had made a good bit of money in sale of land holdings that she had and then mineral rights and whatnot. So she was a lady of some substance. After the riot, she vowed that she would build a house better than the one she had before, and indeed she did. An old feature about that in the Eagle from about 1969 describes the inside in terms of Louis XIV furnishings and gold-plated fixtures and a number of fancy things. The family no longer lives here. Her daughter married and a man named O.B. Prince, and they moved to California in the mid-1960s, but still pay to have the property maintained for them. And going westward on Easton at the next corner, which would be probably Frankfort. On the southwest corner of that intersection is a little one-story stucco building with kind of Roman arches. You can have Roman arches in stucco. That was built by a Creek freedwoman named Ione Watson, who also built many of the houses up and down that block as rental properties. But she built that house for her mother, who lived for a few years in it before her death. And then it became Dr. Bryant's clinic, and most people in Greenwood remember it as the doctor's office. See, there land north of that area, up toward the brick pit, if you were to go on up Frankfort, north of Easton. According to people over at Urban Renewal, there was some title to the land in there which was owned by the Catholic Church and may have been a Catholic school of some kind at one time, but nobody remembers very much about it. Going further west on Easton, there are a number of houses in there that are fascinating and I'm sure have some stories behind them, but the only thing that I can recall, going south from Easton and Frankfort on Frankfort, about midway on the block is a frame house, which was one of the houses that B.C. Franklin, a black attorney and developer, owned. And his son is probably one of Tulsa's most famous black products, Dr. John Hope Franklin, who's a distinguished service professor of history at the University of Chicago. So he grew up part of his childhood in that home. His sister is Mrs. Waldo Jones Sr. And there apparently were four children in the family. I'm not sure where the other two are, but Mrs. Waldo Jones Sr. could give you more information on that area. Okay, coming back up to Easton, going on westward on Easton, is what was most recently known as the Johnson School, C.S. Johnson, S.C. Johnson, whatever, the Johnson School there. The building closest to the corner on which the buildings sit, was built in 1920 as the first permanent building for Booker T. Washington High School. Booker T. had started out about 1911 in the basement of the church and had moved into a frame building which looked about like what these temporary classrooms look like now. And in 1920, when that permanent home was built, that frame building was taken on over to Dunbar School, over where the street garage is, and was used as the cafeteria for Dunbar for a while. That building did survive the riot, the Washington High School building. And then curving on around, if you go north as far as you can go, and then get up onto Haskell, I believe it is, which runs over to Cincinnati, there are several houses left along there. There's an apartment building I don't know anything about. A brick building, which was the home built in the early to mid-1920s by the James Goodwin family, the undertaker and developer. And they're up until recently, when they were taken down because of the Detroit-Cincinnati interchange business, were the houses of Ed and Jean Goodwin and the home of C.W. and Dimple Bush, who was the hospital administrator. Those are gone. Let's see, where are we? Along in there also, if you would follow Easton on over past Charles S. Johnson, that's the name of the school, there's Mount Zion Baptist Church. And Mount Zion, the congregation had been in a new frame building and whatnot, saved their pennies and dimes, and built a new pretty sizable brick building, had completed it in 1921 and had one service in it before the riot, and it was thoroughly gutted and torn down during the riot because it was suspected that the black folks were storing arms and ammunition in there. They went ahead and rebuilt the building after the riot and paid off not only the mortgage on the new building, but the mortgage on the old building. It took them about 4 years, but they paid off both mortgages. Coming back over to Greenwood, going up Greenwood, again, there are a lot of houses and shops and things in there on up toward Marshall, which I don't know that much about. I haven't gotten that far up in terms of talking with people. There's a building just east of Greenwood, a brick building sitting on the south side of the cross street at Newton or Oklahoma, somewhere along there, which was the Variety Health Center of the City County Health Department, is now Muhammad's Mosque, which may have been an early branch library in that area, but I'm really not sure about that. The people up at the North Region Library might be able to tell you more whether or not that was it. And let's see, Carver Middle School is off to the east when you come up to the intersection of Pine and Greenwood. Carver was built in 1928. At that time, the black community built their own schools. They had a separate 2-mill county tax levy, which was mandated by the state, and that was to be used for the building and maintenance of separate but equal black institutions, and that continued up until 1955, a year after the Brown versus the Board of Education case, which ruled separate but equal as an invalid concept. Carver was built in 1928 and was closed in 1972. One of the reasons that there were sit-ins and marches and all kinds of things going on when Carver was closed was because of the prestige of that school in the community. Dunbar, Booker T, and Carver had all been built by the community, but Carver had a special significance. There are still several people alive who were children at the time who remember a Sunday afternoon in the spring when it was kind of rainy and dreary and they had a maypole and danced around listening to speeches. But they watched as the building was dedicated, and the man who was there for the dedication was George Washington Carver himself. And that was a little heavy. And many people still remember that, and I think it's a good part of the reason there was such a confrontation over its closing. Hence its pride now in the black community, and it's being reopened as the Carver Middle School. Moton, across the street there, was the hospital. There used to be a house sitting just northeast of the intersection of Pine and Cincinnati, and that old frame house had a stone part on the back. The frame part on the front had been built in about 1911 or 1912, but the stone part on the back had a date of 1896 on it and had been the cookhouse or the smokehouse for the original building that stood there, and that was a ranch or acreage or something that was owned by a man named Tom Archer. Some relation to the Archer for whom Archer Street was named. He was a merchant prior to the turn of the century. Another thing of significance might be, and I don't know, we'd have to do some checking into it, on East Virgin Street, where Xanthus runs into it, just west of where Virgin is cut off by the Cherokee Expressway, is the Rose Room, which was probably the counterpart within the black community to what Canes and the Blue Moon were within the white community in terms of nightlife. So going back a good ways. At the foot of Greenwood, down there south of Archer and just about even with the row of buildings on the east side of Archer, or of Greenwood, there used to be a night spot which at one time was owned by Clarence Love, It's called Clarence Love's Lounge. Clarence is the coordinator at the Senior Citizen Center up at Pioneer Plaza. And he toured Europe with Clarence Love and his all-girl orchestra for a while. He had people like Sammy Davis Jr. in there and others before they hit the big time. He used to take care of all the little kids and make sure they had sarsaparilla instead of the hard stuff. And was married to a stripper whose name, after she was married, became Bumps Love. So kind of interesting stories involved there. I don't think of any other places right off the end. I think that covers pretty well the ones on here. There's one other place that might be worth some checking. On the bridge over the railroad tracks on Cheyenne going northward, there are two buildings that just stick up just above the roadway, like half a story or one story, and then go all the way down to the ground along the tracks. And one of them says sewer, and one of them says water, or one of them says streets, and one of them says water, or something. And they look as though they may be old city offices of some kind. But nobody I've ever talked to, I talked to Commissioner Thomas about it at one point, some other people, and nobody could remember ever having heard about them or known when they might have been used. They are on city property because that fire station is right there. Mm-hmm. But when they were built or what they were used for, nobody seems to know.
Do you know anything about the area around Terry's old bookstore? There's a theater, Cozy Theater.
I don't know anything about that area. I wish I did. It looks fascinating.
And the area down below the overpasses is intriguing because it's sort of like the underground and things like that.
Those overpasses weren't built until sometime in the 20s or early 30s. The original overpasses were WPA kinds of things, as I understood. So a lot of that was just at grade level, and for most of it, those early decades of the century. That area along Archer, Brady, Cameron, up and down Denver, Cheyenne, Boulder, Maine, Boston, those were all parts of the main part of downtown up until 1920, or maybe even a little bit later. The major buildings south of the tracks, there were buildings there and there were businesses there, but much of the activity, the rooming houses and whatnot, was up there on the north side. The Tribune, in fact, if the Tribune sat there on the north side, is probably a good indication of it being close to where the action was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's go back to the riot. In 1921, on the last day of May, which as I recall was a Tuesday, I'm doing some stories about it, that was the night, the day of the night of... Okay, the last day of May in 1921 was the day of the evening for the first Booker T. Washington High School prom. And W.D. Williams, whom I mentioned earlier, was the class treasurer for the junior class. His family owned the building down on the corner of Greenwood. And as he recalls what happened, mixing it together with recollections of some other people, sometime earlier in that day, a young man named Dick Rowland, who was a guy who dropped out of high school, a black guy, and had been working as a boot black, got on the elevator at the Drexel building, which was at 3rd and, I believe, Main Street in downtown. It's no longer there. There was an 18-year-old white woman working as elevator operator named Sarah Page. He got on the elevator and they started up or down or whichever way they were going. She screamed, some people came, and she claimed that he had attacked her in some way, threatened her. He took on out. A complaint was filed. The county sheriff's office began a fairly quiet investigation to see what would happen, but the rumors had begun building. By mid-afternoon, the rumor was that he'd attempted to rape her, which would have been a pretty trick on an elevator, I would think. He may have touched her arm, he may have looked at her, who knows what happened, but anyhow, it got blown up. Let's see, what happened next? the word spread around. That was a time when there were a lot of tensions, the 1920, 1921 one, and there were heavy times for activities of the Klan throughout this part of the country, and other groups very conscious of racial separation and white supremacy, and that kind of thing following World War I. We had full page ads in both parts of papers at that time, advertising for membership in the Klans and the torchlight riots and the whole business. So against that backdrop, plus people having just returned from overseas in the World War, many of them with souvenirs that they brought back, and what, firearms and knives and things, made for kind of a tense situation. Things were going along fairly well until the rumors began building and getting out of proportion, and there were some fears. So sometime that afternoon, the sheriff decided he better arrest Roland and put him in the county jail, partly for his own protection. About that time, the Tulsa Tribune hit the streets that afternoon with a front page story, which I have five people have told me now, was headlined something like, "To Lynch a Negro Tonight." And that I've never been able to document, because if you go over to the files of the newspaper in the library, the microfilmed copies, portion of the front page of the paper that day is missing, as is the editorial column, was torn off before they were microfilmed, so there's no way of really documenting it. Roland was arrested, taken down to the county courthouse, which was where 4th National Bank is now, on the corner of 6th and Boulder. Is that Cheyenne? Boulder. Yeah, Boulder. That street and water building is on Boulder, not Cheyenne. He was taken upstairs to where the jail was. As a safety precaution, they cut off the electricity to the elevators, which meant the only way up to the jail, is that doing something funny, was by a stairway, which was narrow, and probably only one or two people at a time could get up. But guards were stationed at every floor. For the next 2 or 3 days, Roland was probably the safest man in Tulsa. Okay, word spread quickly among the white community that Roland had been arrested. It also spread back to the black community. Mr. Williams remembers somebody jumping up on the stage at the Dreamland Theater and giving the news that Roland had been taken downtown, that he was being charged with rape, and nobody figured he would last very long. Okay, the word was spread. Somebody jumped up on the stage at the Dreamland Theater and announced this. Black folks decided that if there was a black man in the county jail charged with rape, and there were newspapers with headlines like that, he wasn't going to last too long. So they headed down to try to protect him. Formed a ring around the courthouse. White folks started showing up to see what was going on. And as things grew tenser and tenser, a black deputy sheriff named Barney Cleaver went out to talk to the crowd. Cleaver lived in Greenwood and lost several tens of thousands of dollars worth of his own property in the riot. But he had just about convinced the black folks to go back to Greenwood and let the law take its course, that they had things under control. And the black folks had just started to disperse when somebody fired a shot, and no one was ever able to determine whether it was white or black or green or yellow. The result was a free-for-all in which the blacks were forced up North Boulder Avenue to the tracks. The tracks became kind of a no-man's land downtown. Pawn shops and whatnot were broken into for guns and ammunition. There are reports of people driving around in open cars with mounted guns in them. The Klan, I'm sure, was in evidence, though I don't think the regalia was seen very much. And firing continued across the tracks into the night, and finally broke across the tracks. Mr. Williams remembers making it to the prom that night, but rather sitting up on top of one of the buildings in Greenwood loading guns for his father, trying to protect the family buildings. Somewhere around 2 a.m. on June 1st, the governor of the state declared martial law in Tulsa and sent the National Guard in. They arrived sometime before morning and tried to renew order in the city. There were reports that blacks were coming from Muskogee as reinforcements for the blacks in Tulsa, and parties were sent down there to head them off. They never materialized. The white folks pushed the blacks back into Greenwood, and then over the next 24 to 36 hours proceeded to destroy, raise to the ground somewhere between 15 and 24 square blocks. Black folks fled. Many were captured and taken to one of two internment places. One was at the convention hall. The other was at McClure Park, which was a baseball diamond kind of thing.
Still living down on Cincinnati, and the people were celebrating all up and down Main Street, and Main Street was paved with bricks then. It didn't go very far, but
okay, those that were captured were taken to internment posts at the convention hall in the McClure Park, which was a baseball field and whatnot, located where the old warehouse market is down there with the tower on Frankfurt or whatever on 11th Street. Some were taken to First Presbyterian Church, which was set up as an emergency medical facility at that time. Others fled, going as far as Bartlesville and further north, some up into Kansas, and a friend of mine who several years ago spent a summer up in Nova Scotia discovered a small black, basically black farming community there where the folks traced their lineage back to Tulsa in 1921. So it was rather traumatic for many of the people involved. The official records indicated very few people killed, 15 whites and 25 blacks or something like that. Those figures are in the Tulsa 75 history book. But there are many people who recall seeing truckloads of black bodies primarily being hauled down and dumped in the river. Now, how accurate their recollections are, I don't know. There's no way of knowing how many people were killed. The Tulsa Tribune became very apologetic with a series of front page editorials urging binding the community up, restoring order and whatnot. An inside story two or three days after the riot had a funny little story about a black woman climbing up Standpipe Hill with some large wooden object under her arm. And approaching a National Guardsman standing guard up there by the machine gun that had been stationed there, and telling him that her house had been all torn down and everything, and all she had been able to salvage was her religious records, and she wanted him to have them because she had no place to play them anymore. And it was all done in Negro dialect kind of reporting, which, looking back at it now, looks pretty tacky. We also made front page history for 4 days running in the New York Times. And there was a Times correspondent who just happened to be traveling through this area when the riot broke out, and he stayed here to cover the riot. His granddaughter, ironically enough, is now the secretary to Commissioner Eagleton. Her name is Pam Greenwood. I don't know what information. Okay, the granddaughter of the man who covered the riot for the New York Times is Pam Greenwood, who is the secretary to Commissioner Norma Eagleton. She's been in Tulsa for two or three or four years and done several things here, but she's one of the few people I've known who knew about the riot before they came to town. Most people don't even know about it after they came to town. The Greenwood community was rebuilt after the riot. There was still rather prosperous people at that point, and continued on up through the 1920s, 30s, 40s as a fairly prosperous community, partly due to segregation. Money had to be brought back to that community to be spent. could go out and work in Mrs. O'Leary's house or in the oil fields or on the railroads, but you'd have to come back to Greenwood to be able to buy anything because you couldn't buy in white stores and stuff. So the money continually was brought back into the community, recycled, and so forth. It wasn't until the 1950s that Greenwood began to really deteriorate. In 1938, for example, the Greenwood Chamber of Commerce had been publishing annual business directories for several years. And the 1938 edition, which I have seen, listed over 400 black businesses. You'd be lucky to find about 40 or 50 today, if that many. But it was when integration began to occur and nobody had to come back to Greenwood. They could buy in the Safeways and whatnot, that the money started going out of the community. And in effect, resulted in the creation of a new poverty class, the black merchant class, which had never been poor before. I think that's about all I can think of right offhand about the riot. And I think that's probably about all I can think of on anything at this point.